I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we want to take a closer look at Congress's efforts to create more jobs. After weeks of negotiations, 70 senators voted in support of a plan that calls for tax breaks to encourage hiring and extends funding for highway and mass transit programs through the spring construction season. The bill now goes to the House, whose members passed a much bigger bill last December. Now, supporters of the bill are saying it's time that Congress move to address the country's terrible unemployment situation. But not surprisingly, the bill has critics on the left and the right who either call it too puny or too expensive. In a moment, we'll hear from the Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition for his take on whether the legislation will do anything to help the groups hardest hit by unemployment, especially African Americans. But first, we want to hear from Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey. He's one of the 70 members, including 55 Democrats, who voted in support of the bill yesterday. We reached him at his office on Capitol Hill. Welcome to the program, or I should say welcome back.
Thank you, Michelle. Good to be with you again.
Now, before we jump into the jobs bill, the other big news out of Washington today is that the president is meeting with a number of congressional leaders to talk about the health care overhaul. When we last spoke to you, we talked about health care. What do you hope will come out of this meeting?
Well, my hope is that Republicans who have had many of their ideas already incorporated to the process that we went through in the Senate in the committees and amendments and many ideas that the president incorporated in his version of health care will find common ground with us and help us move forward in achieving lowering costs for everyone who has health insurance and stop the double-digit premium increases. Side with us, instead of the insurance companies who are consistently denying people who have health care coverage when they file a claim and need it the most, and ensure millions more of Americans who have no health insurance whatsoever. So that's our hope. I want to be an optimist. I'm concerned when Republicans prior to today simply said that they see this whole effort as the president trying to lay a trap for them. If that's the mindset that you go to the meeting with, I'm not sure it's the most positive one in order to achieve common cause, but that's what we hope will happen.
But is the setting itself a one where you really can negotiate? I mean, is a televised meeting really a place to negotiate something like that, or really is it just theater?
Well, no, I think, first of all, remember that one of the Republicans' claims is that there has been a lack of transparency. So here's the ultimate transparency. Two is the fact that while everything won't be negotiated at this day's event, you could have a foundation upon which you could build. And I'm sure that's the intention that the president has. But, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that there's been a lack of transparency, and then when there is full transparency, say that it's not a good way to negotiate.
When we last spoke, we talked about the health bill that at the time was the major focus of attention, both by the White House and by the congressional leadership. And at the time, you still were not fully pleased with the bill. At the time, it didn't really include a public option. But you were optimistic. You said, you know, you felt that at the end of the day, there would be some form of legislation that would achieve the goal of near universal, if not universal, coverage that would lower costs and that would be politically palatable. Do you still feel that way? Do you still feel that that can happen?
I do. I do. And I think that, you know, the president who put out his own version, which is largely mirrored after the Senate version, but does take some of the House's versions and tries to, you know, split some of the differences on creating greater affordability for middle-class families. We're all for that. How we fund the bill in terms of making sure it's fully paid for, keeping it below certain levels of in terms of overall expenditure. But above all, in reducing costs for families who have it, ending insurance company abuses like pre-existing conditions, lifetime caps, extending the age up to 26 where you can keep your child on your health insurance, and bringing, you know, 30, 35 million more Americans into health care is a template that he put forward. I think there's a few refinements to it, but at the end of the day, I see a pathway, hopefully with Republicans, but in the absence of them wanting to join us to achieve those overarching goals, I still see a pathway for it to happen.
And let's talk about the jobs bill now. Why did you vote for it?
Well, I voted for it because, first of all, this is the beginning of a jobs agenda. This is not the total jobs agenda. And anyone who looks at this and says, well, it wasn't enough, should be thinking about that this is the first installment. But it's a very significant installment. It creates payroll tax relief for businesses that are willing to hire people, which is what we want to see. We want to see incentives for businesses to hire people because they're going to, at the end of the day, hire more people than anybody the government can. And it does so in a way that not only encourages them to hire by that payroll tax relief, but if they keep that person employed for a year or more, they get an additional $1,000 credit. It also gives tax relief for small businesses that purchase major equipment to help them expand or to help them continue to make their business vibrant. The people who create those equipment, who deliver that equipment, who install that equipment are all going to be put to work, and obviously that business is going to enhance its productivity and in doing so be able to hire more people. The extension of the Highway Trust Fund, incredibly important for infrastructure investment across the country, saving over 1 million jobs, the Congressional Budget Office tells us. And finally, the expansion of the Build America Bonds, which is a program that allows states to finance all types of infrastructure projects, including school construction and renovation, energy projects. Those are critical and a great opportunity for more work to be created. So, you know, job creation is number one for us, and I think this legislation is an important first step in our jobs agenda.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey. He's a Democrat. We're talking about the jobs bill that passed in the Senate yesterday. It did pass with bipartisan support. 55 Democrats were joined by 15 Republicans. You're saying it's it was a phrase you just used, and it basically said, well, this is the first step. There are critics on both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, and also I think, you know, out among the voters, who are saying that why did it take so long to focus on jobs? As you know, a number of people are criticizing both the president and the Democratic leadership for not prioritizing the job situation first. What do you say to that?
Well, I say that the economic recovery package was all about both stabilizing an economy that was ready to go into a deep depression and in doing so save jobs and create jobs. I mean, people forget that over 40% of the Recovery Act were tax cuts that helped people put more money in their pocket and therefore expand on critical needs, which created stimulus in our economy that would help create jobs. I remind them that the omnibus bill last year, the appropriations bill, had several elements in there to help create jobs. And even health care. At the end of the day, if you get health care reform the way Democrats envision it, it's about jobs as well, because if you continue to have double-digit premium increases for health insurance, then businesses have less money to hire people. Individuals have less money who may not get it at their place of work to spend in the economy and therefore create a demand for jobs and services. And at the same time, when you bring 30 to 35 million new Americans into health care, fully paid for, you create a demand for the delivery of health care services to all those individuals who presently don't have insurance. So that in and of itself is a jobs program too. So I look at all of these elements and say to myself, we have been working on jobs. Obviously, you can't take an economy that was on the verge of a depression where we inherited huge job losses, have not only ended, for the most part, those job losses, stabilized it, now see growth, and turn it around overnight. We are continuing to work on this, and we will be focused like a laser beam continuously, as we have to some degree last year, on some of the most critical issues that created the opportunity for growth to take place and jobs to be created.
And, oh, sorry, let me just correct myself, that there were 13 other Republicans. 13 Republicans voted with the Democratic majority for the bill. The other two, of course, votes came from independents. And so let me just correct that on its face. Now, of course, on the other side of it, there are those who are saying that Democrats haven't done enough, that the leadership hasn't done enough. On the other side of it, there are people who are now very worried about the deficit and that they say that there isn't enough attention being paid to this kind of looming problem. How do you balance out those priorities in your own mind?
Well, first of all, you know, we are concerned about a deficit, and that's why Democrats alone, without Republican votes, passed budget discipline procedures like pay-as-you-go, which means you have a new program you want to have, or you want to have a tax cut you want to give, then you have to pay for it. You have to find the funding source. That's something that hasn't happened in the Congress. Republicans wouldn't join us in that budget discipline Democrats pushed that forward. So now any proposal, including the jobs bill we voted on yesterday, is fully paid for. And that's going to help us stop the reduction of, begin into the process of reducing the debt instead of adding to it. Secondly, many of us, myself included, voted for a commission that is now being put forth by the president, but we voted for a statutory one to deal with our long-term debt and to bring that under control and reduce it. You know, 9 Republican senators who actually were co-sponsors of the legislation ended up voting against it. It's an example of the difference between what you say and what you do, and how, you know, Republicans, for the sake of having the president fail on all of these issues, are even willing to vote against those pieces of legislation that they co-sponsored in the first place.
Well, then finally, and we only have about a minute left, given that, what's the basis of your optimism that you're going to be able to move forward both on health care and on other measures that you feel are necessary? You call this a first step. What's the source of your optimism?
Well, I think on the critical issues of jobs, we saw that Republicans, when we forced the issue, are willing to join us because they understand they can't go back to their constituents and say, I'm voting against jobs initiatives. And on health care, hopefully we will have Republicans, but if not, there is a process, a budgetary process, that would allow us to move forward called reconciliation, and that may very well be the vehicle that we'll have to use if we can't get bipartisan support to bring down costs on health care, to give people more insurance, and to stop insurance companies from arbitrarily and capriciously denying our consumers.
Robert Menendez is a Democrat. He represents New Jersey in the United States Senate. He was kind enough to join us from his office on Capitol Hill. Senator, thank you so much for speaking
thank
with
you,
us.
Michelle. Have a good day.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, we'll talk about a change in a long tradition at Ole Miss, and we'll have our final conversation for Black History Month. That's all coming up a bit later. But we wanted to talk a bit more about the jobs bill and how it might affect particularly people of color who are unemployed. So we've called for additional perspective the Reverend Jesse Jackson, president and founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition. Of course, he's a longtime civil rights activist, a former Democratic presidential candidate, and he's with us by phone from London. Welcome. Welcome back, I should say.
Very well.
How do you respond to this move? I mean, obviously a lot of Democrats in the Senate are relieved that the Congress is finally perceived to be doing something to address the unemployment problem. Do you feel similarly encouraged?
Well, it is a gesture in the right direction, but it does not correspond to the size of the problem. Maybe 20 million Americans are unemployed. Suggests about 9.7 Americans generally, and for African Americans about 20%, and some of these ghettos up to 25% in barrios. So about 20 million Americans unemployed, about 40 million in poverty. It does not correspond to the size of the problem. Wall Street got a bailout, but the working people are really getting a gesture by comparison.
The bill does a couple of things, and of course it has to go to the House now and be reconciled with the House, which has some different ideas about what should happen, but it will reauthorize through the end of 2010 the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which uses gasoline taxes to help state and local governments pay for highway and transit projects. And it also, a significant feature of the bill is a tax credit for companies that hire unemployed workers. The provision exempts workers from paying the Social Security payroll tax this year, and they get an additional credit if the workers stay hired through the end of the year, for at least a year, I should say. That's about a $13 billion sort of tax credit. It also gives some businesses tax credits for – it accelerates how they can sort of pay for new expenditures. So what about that?
Put direct jobs over the tax credit, which has a plus. But rules of us, WPA, Workers Progress, and the CCC, direct jobs is an answer to where you have these areas of 20-25% unemployment. Plus, Michelle, you have the hemorrhaging of jobs. In Chicago last week, they laid off 1,100 transit workers. I think more than 1,000 transit workers laid off in New York, putting buses on mothballs in Cleveland, in Atlanta. So we're still hemorrhaging jobs with the trade imbalance and home foreclosures and student loan defaults and credit card scams. Even as we put a few more jobs on the top, we've not yet stopped the hemorrhaging of manufacturing jobs and houses, and now church foreclosures and student loan defaults.
But you're convinced that direct hiring by the government is the best way to address this problem right now? Because the president seems to disagree with you. He feels that sort of encouraging businesses to hire more people is more efficient, and they can actually get them on the payroll sooner.
You just don't agree. Like Inglewood, where the president was an organizer, where you have a crisis of plants closing, jobs leaving, high crime rate of violence, lack of adequate access to transportation. It's not an environment in which small businesses are likely to locate to get the tax credit. You're going to need in those areas a stronger rope because people are much further down. You're going to need more than a tax credit.
Now, there was a fairly robust bipartisan vote to advance this bill on the Senate side. It was a 70-28 vote. Obviously, there were a number of Republicans who joined with Democrats to pass the bill. But as you know, because you know you've been in and out of Washington, you know, a lot, there's a fairly, some people would say, poisonous atmosphere around advancing major legislation. The last piece of legislation was passed around on Christmas Eve, which was the health care bill, which is, of course, has been embroiled in intense fighting ever since. I think the question I would have is there the political will to make the kind of big move forward on a job stimulus plan that you think is necessary? I mean, can they do it?
Unemployment now is so pervasive. As they move toward election November, they want to do something. They can't say they're against a jobs bill, but that something does not correspond with the size of the problem. Look at what we did with the banks, these multi-billion-dollar bailout deals without linkage to lending. When we put trading and lending in the same shop, and they chose trading over lending, got huge bonuses, and now Wall Street is rising, but unemployment is rising. We're still hemorrhaging jobs. And just to think about Chicago, New York, Memphis, Oakland, and Atlanta, laying off thousands of transit workers, putting buses and trains in mothballs. We have to look at, in a very real way, economic reconstruction, some real plan for economic reconstruction. I was impressed, frankly, when Roosevelt's approach was to restructure banks, not just refortify them, and take lending and trading from under the same roof, a strong SEC, a strong FDIC, direct jobs, and if you will, a chicken in every pot. Now, that's important because 50 million Americans are food challenged, are food insecure. So these issues of the food insecurity and the lack of jobs among the common people and the traders keep trading. I'm here in Britain today, and whether it's the Royal Bank of Scotland here or the bank in Germany or the Netherlands or Belgium or Wall Street, it's the same phenomena. Where banks have used their concentrated power to lift themselves up and get bailed out by the people, but don't bail the people once they get bailed out by the people.
But why do you think that Washington is having such a hard time achieving consensus on the next steps forward? Obviously, you know, you hear a lot of the Republican leadership say that they are deeply worried about the deficit. They say that the country cannot afford very much more spending. You know, a number of Republicans did join with Democrats to advance this bill in the Senate. But I'm just asking, what is your assessment of why you see it as sort of a clear and present and obvious crisis for the country? But I'm just wondering, why do you think it is that a number of other people just don't seem to see it the way you do, or they're just having trouble getting consensus on what to do?
I don't know why there's so much difference to the rich and powerful and so much contempt for the poor. Maybe is that the rich and powerful have lobbyists, and the lobbyists get the first seat at the table. And so bailout banks, they're too big to fail a year ago, now they're twice as big and expressing contempt by not reinvesting. Even in the health care bill, the pharmaceuticals and the hospitals are at the table first and demanding more. And they tend to invest heavily in those who do the voting.
And I wanted to ask you, I don't know, on a different note, that there's been I don't know if you've been made aware of it, that there's been this kind of dust-up earlier in the week between the political commentator Tavis Smiley and the Reverend Al Sharpton. And they had a kind of an ongoing dispute on the air on various programs about whether President Obama is taking the problems of the black community seriously enough and whether there needs to be a more focused agenda directed at African Americans who are suffering, as of course you know, disproportionately from high unemployment. And Reverend Sharpton was invited to the White House to talk about these issues. What is your take on this?
Well, Americans who are black, Americans who are Latino are facing disproportionate pain. We were the victims of reverse redlining by the banks. So banks profiled, targeted, student clustered homes. And most of our equity has been in homes, been ripped off by banks who should have been creditors became predators. For example, as I said, Chicago, 3,500 Chicagoans die a year in one city from health care disparities. We're number one in infant mortality, number one in short life expectancy, number one in unemployment, number one in lack of access to capital. And so those Americans, whether they are black or Latino or whether they're white in Appalachian, deserve special consideration because they're in America's emergency room. And, of course, presidents always, because of this racial issue, as America's moral dilemma, whether it's Lincoln or Truman or Eisenhower or Kennedy or Johnson or Clinton, ultimately, greatness was defined by how they treated that dilemma and how they, in fact, treated the least of these.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, the president and founder of the Rainbow Push Coalition, as we mentioned, he's in London, and we reached him there where he's receiving a number of honors, and he's also working on continuing his work on political activism there and working on voter registration efforts overseas. So, Reverend Jackson, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now we want to move to the first of two stories that touch on how the country is grappling with race right now. Both stories take place on college campuses. First, the students at the University of Mississippi, also known as Ole Miss, just voted to have students design a new mascot that officially ends the reign of the controversial Colonel Reb. That's a symbol of the state's Confederate history. The university decided to ban Colonel Reb from events in 2003 because many found the image increasingly offensive. This decision came after a hard-fought battle that divided the Ole Miss student body, faculty, and alumni for years. We wanted to know more about this, so we called Alex McDaniel. She is a senior at the University of Mississippi and editor of the Daily Mississippian, Ole Miss's campus newspaper. Alex, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, what can you tell us about today's vote? Was there wide participation? I assume it was an online vote.
Yes, the vote took place on Tuesday, and it was open to all full-time students at the university. We boast about 18,000 enrolled students, not sure how many full-time, but there'd been more build-up from the week before when we had our student government elections, and everybody knew it was coming, so we had some advertising campaigns from different organizations coming out, and a lot of campaigning, a lot of lobbying, a lot of influence, and when it came down to the voting, I don't think anybody on campus was sure how it was going to turn out just based on the fact that for the past 7 years, there has been so much controversy about it. So when it came down and found out that, 75% of those who voted actually voted to move forward, I think it marked a pretty significant day just in our university's history.
As you said, nearly 75% of the votes cast voted to move forward, whether to support a student-led effort to develop and propose a new on-field mascot, but as I understand it, only about 3,300 votes were cast. A little more than 3,300 votes were cast, How do you interpret that?
Honestly, judging based on past student government elections and things like that we've had, that was actually pretty impressive, especially for a referendum. At the same time, though, I think there has been criticism. Is this an apathetic campus? Do they really care? What happened? There were a few different elements going into it, though. For one, there wasn't a lot of communication from the student government to media sources, including the Daily Mississippian, about what this vote actually meant. And for weeks, we were reporting, based on interviews, that it was just a vote whether you wanted a new mascot or you didn't. And it wasn't until Sunday night, when I was putting the paper together for the next day, we dedicated the entire front page to explaining what the vote meant, which actually was, do you want the students to lead it or do you not? And after that, there was a lot of confusion. A lot of the different organizations that were pro-Colonel Reb started fighting it and saying it was a lie and it was propaganda. And so I think a lot of it has to do with maybe a lot of students were too confused to want to vote. But even then, it was actually a pretty impressive turnout based on elections that we've had.
And I was going to ask you that leads to my next question, which is what were the arguments on both sides? I can understand. I think people who've ever seen Colonel Reb would understand why many people would say, this isn't really the image we need right now for this mm-hmm. for this era. This is a diverse campus now. It's not, celebrating the Confederate general is not necessarily the way we want to be viewed by the rest mm-hmm. of the country right now. But what were the arguments on the other side for keeping Colonel Reb?
Well, I think the primary argument that we're hearing or that we've heard in the past few weeks is that most of the people that are pro-Colonel Reb They just love him because he's a symbol of the university, that they're not trying to promote anything divisive. They're not trying to promote a racist symbol, but that it meant so much to them that that they should, you know, try to retain it. However, this wasn't about intent. It was about perception. And that was the one thing that I think was lost on people on both sides, is that regardless of how many people are attached to the symbol, regardless of how many people view it as just school spirit, they're not considering what that looks among this, you know, in the South and in the nation for the state of Mississippi.
What were some of the student-to-student conversations like about this? I don't know if you participated in any, you know, where people just say, you know, they're, you know, having lunch together, dinner together, and just talking about things. What were there a lot of student-to-student conversation about it? What was that like?
Well, I think the main thing between students is that the administration already said Colonel Reb was not an option. He was not coming back, that there was no way this vote could revive him and bring him back as an on-field mascot. So I think a lot of the students were stuck on that and just said, you know, I don't really understand what being for Colonel Reb would, or being pro-Colonel Reb would actually do, considering he's not coming back. And then on the other side, you have people, I mean, these students have been without a mascot for 7 years. Most of the people that voted, a great deal of people that voted, weren't even here. We were teenagers in high school when this happened, so we're not used to having an on-field mascot. So I think a lot of it was just kind of feeling like we were stuck in the middle of a battle between alumni and administration, because it's the alumni that were passionate about it. This was their mascot, but, you know, this is a new student body. This is not the student body of 2003. And I think that was probably the primary thing was just, you know, where do we fit in all this, and where does our opinion fall?
And I was going to ask you about that. Did in a way you had to have been, you know, when this first started, you were a preteen even, and for most of the students there. So did it seem a little stupid in a way? A little.
I wouldn't say stupid. I mean, my father was born and raised in Mississippi, and he grew up in the 50s and 60s, and he was always used to, you know, seeing the Colonel Reb symbol. And, you know, every time I go home, there's a Colonel Reb statue in my front yard. Yes, there is. And it's all it is about school spirit. And we live in Arkansas, so in a way, it's kind of debunking the Razorbacks. But it does seem silly to put so much emphasis and so much effort and so much money into trying to influence the student body when we're really talking about a cartoon, because this isn't an issue of a mascot. It's an issue of a university that's been thriving, a university that's made great strides and is actually quite progressive, but is so limited by being attached to these symbols that create this kind of division, this kind of controversy. So I think that was a very prevalent opinion as far as why are we focusing on this cartoon when we have a university and an educational institution we need to focus on.
So what's going to happen to your Colonel Reb in the front yard? What are you going to do with him?
Oh, I'm sure it'll stay. You know, it's one of those that it's less about Colonel Reb. It's more about Ole Miss with my family. I mean, it's mainly, you know, support that I'm getting an education and everything like that. I'm sure when we do develop a new mascot, if they make a new statue, I guarantee you it'll be right there with it. It's more of just kind of a novelty item. People are used to it. But that's, you know, that's another thing too. The university was very inconsistent after removing Colonel Reb in 2003, because they continued to use the symbol on merchandise. That's why there are Colonel Reb statues and Colonel Reb t-shirts and hats and everything else.
That's worth pointing out. I appreciate it. So, Alex, I understand you're a student journalist, and so we're not really asking for your personal opinion here, but just me to you, do you have a vote for what you think the next mascot should be? Do you have a preference?
Well, I know all the stuff about Admiral Ackbar from Star Wars has come down and kind of brought some light in our university. You know, I just think as long as it's truly a student-led initiative and that it's not just the student government or just a small group of student leaders who are making all the decisions, if the entire student body gets the opportunity to come together and choose something, you know, I think we have the chance to develop something really great and something that's representative of our university rather than representative of a time that we don't want to remember anymore.
How about an Alex statue?
I'm sure my dad wouldn't be opposed to it, but I don't know how that would look, you know, to everybody else. But we'll see what happens. It's a really exciting time right now at Ole Miss.
All right. Alex McDaniel is the editor of the Daily Mississippian, the University of Mississippi's campus newspaper. She joined us from Oxford. Alex, thank you. Good luck to you as well. And congratulations on your senior year.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we conclude our Black History Month series with a closer look at race relations in the North. Historian Jason Sokol wrote about this in his new book, The Northern Mystique, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, and we'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about another campus controversy with racial overtones, this at the University of California at San Diego. A party hosted by a white fraternity there earlier this month has sparked a tremendous response. They called it the Compton Cookout, and partygoers were encouraged to dress and speak in a manner that many other students found stereotypical and offensive. After several student organizations spoke out against the event, the editor of a campus newspaper appeared on a student-run television last week to mock the protesters. He slurred Black demonstrators as, and I have to warn you, this will be offensive to many listeners, as ungrateful niggers. Now, the university's student president has shut down the student-run station and frozen all student fees to campus media organizations. We wanted to know more about this call. We've called Utsav Gupta. He's the student president of UC San Diego. He's with us now. Also with us is Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs, Penny Rue. And I thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me as well.
Well, thank you for coming. And Utsav, what prompted you to take this action?
Well, I went to the Black Caucus Forum on Thursday, just this past Thursday, and then I witnessed the protest on Friday, and I saw the pain on people's faces. Students were scarred by the comments that have been made by the Qualo, which is a very controversial publication here at UC San Diego, and they were demanding a freeze for their student fees going into this publication.
And what about the issue of free speech, which I'm sure that some have raised?
Sure. I mean, this is not an issue of free speech. This is an issue of how we decide to fund student organizations. Any student government has the ability to set objective criteria on how it funds student media on its campus. And that's what we're reviewing here. We've been content neutral in the way we've instituted the freeze. The freeze affects all campus media outlets, just to give us time to review how we do it.
Mm. Well, I think that would be the other question. Penny, I haven't forgotten about you, but there would be those who would argue, why should students who are handling their responsibilities responsibly be punished along with those who are engaging in a manner of speech or inactivities that some might find offensive? Utsav?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yes. The issue is not that this is some sort of punishment to all those organizations. This is really a call for action on intolerant comments made by one particular media organization. It's saying that what is the threshold for intolerance that is going to be supported by our student association? What is our student association here to do? I believe our student association is here to represent all of the collective interests of every member of that association, and if we're supporting an activity that is hurting even one single member of our association, that's something we should review.
And Penny, what's the school administration's role in this controversy?
We're obviously concerned about the larger issue of climate and well-being, and our concern is to make sure that our students are able to focus and concentrate on their academics, to be able to live and work in a climate that's supportive of them. So student safety, student well-being is our highest priority. I'm very proud of the work that UTSAF is doing in confronting kind of a pernicious campus challenge, and we're very supportive of that as well.
You know, I understand it was reported in the LA Times today that Black students walked out of a teach-in on campus yesterday because they were saying that they don't believe the administration is going to do anything significant to address this. So, Penny, I wanted to ask you first of all, do you think how do you respond to that criticism? And what do you think the atmosphere on campus is like for students of different backgrounds? They seem to feel that there's a certain sort of toxic environment, that there's a certain hostility that they're experiencing. Do you think that that's true?
You know, we're an extremely diverse campus, and the challenge is that our African-American students are seriously underrepresented. So we completely understand that they feel isolated, but lots of students have aligned in solidarity with them, and so I think they've been able truly to see the depth of the support that they have on campus. And yesterday's rally that the students handled was a beautiful example of that, and I was actually quite quite proud of our student organizers for finding their voice and for the community for supporting them.
How do you respond to the editor of that paper, that campus newspaper, who uttered those words about the student demonstrators being ungrateful? And I just don't need to repeat it again, the N-word. What's that about?
It's so completely heinous, but the interesting thing about this publication is it's in its heyday right now. They live to create controversy. So this is exactly the kind of reaction that they would hope for. And I try not to dignify them with our attention, but when it crosses a line like this, as I've said, it's imperative that we respond.
Is there any response? Is there any official response to this this utterance by this person on a campus-run station at a campus? It's a campus publication on a campus-run station. Is there going to be any response by the university to these comments?
Certainly. The institution is currently investigating all the standards of conduct that may have been violated in this incident. Because it involves an individual student judicial record, I'm not at liberty to discuss that investigation. But I can tell you that we really believe that the remedy for silly or offensive speech is more speech, not less. Mm-hmm. And so my goal is to make sure that our collective voices are heard, that this will not be tolerated, that this is an outrage, and to isolate this student and his asinine friends that conspired with him to essentially hijack our student-run television system in this heinous way.
You were saying that this newspaper exists to be provocative. As I understand it, they've been accused of slurring Asians, Jews, Mormons, Indians. They've even been accused of mocking the earthquake victims in Haiti in the latest issue. So I understand that what you're saying, that this is meant to be provocative. That's a final thought from you. What do you think should happen going forward? How do you think these issues should be addressed going forward? And what do you think the atmosphere is like on campus for people from diverse backgrounds?
Sure. From this point forward, I think it's going to take a lot of dialogue between a lot of different campus communities and a lot of different students. And I'm happy that at this campus we're finally having this dialogue, that we're talking about how we feel on this campus, and that this is an issue that's probably not going to go away. This is an issue that we're going to be talking about for quite a bit. And I think that it's really important that this dialogue is happening. I think, the steps are going to be we really need to come together as a community. We need to come together as students. We need to talk about what we need to do as an institution to make sure that every student here feels safe, that every student here feels that they're welcome and that they can be provided an education.
It may be a silly question because you're the president of the student body, but do you feel safe and welcome at the university?
I personally feel pretty safe here at the university. I think the university does do a good job at making students feel safe, but I think this is an issue of a campus climate that affects just some students here at the university. And that's something that just because I feel safe and someone else doesn't feel safe, that doesn't mean I can ignore that.
All right. Atsav Gupta is the president of the student body at the University of California, San Diego. Penny Rue is the vice chancellor of student affairs there. And they were both kind enough to join us from their offices on campus there. And we appreciate your taking the time. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for our final installment of the conversations we've been having for Black History Month. While much has been documented about the history of Africans in America, so much more continues to be discovered. We've been focusing on new research and journalism that illuminates the history of people of African descent in this country. With us today is Jason Sokol. He is a lecturer in Harvard University's Department of African and African American Studies and a resident fellow at the Du Bois Institute. His work there involves a new book project about politics and race in the Northeast. It's titled The Northern Mystique, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. I hope he doesn't mind my mentioning that Jason has been feted as one of America's top young historians, and he joins us now. Welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Pleasure being with you.
First of all, can I just ask how you were drawn to this field or why you were drawn to the field of African-American studies?
Well, I grew up in a somewhat racially integrated small city, Springfield, Massachusetts. Went to somewhat integrated schools. And I think from a very young age, I just realized that there was something there about race in America that sort of compelled my attention. And then so when I got to school and to college and got to read all about the civil rights movement, I was hooked.
Well, I want to talk about the book title, The Northern Mystique. And we've talked a lot in this country in documentaries, in sort of historical works, about race and politics in the South, largely because of slavery, Jim Crow, and the Civil Rights Movement. What is the Northern mystique? What does that refer to?
It refers to an idea that the North, and particularly the Northeast, I think, I'm thinking about New England and New York City, have a mystique about them in terms of politics and culture and race relations, that things are possible in the North that aren't in the South. It's not a complete myth. It's a mystique. And some of it is grounded in truth. For instance, African Americans could vote in the North and they could in the South. And some of it is not so true. The sobering realities of racial segregation in the North and racial violence and racism persist, and they puncture that mystique. The biggest thing is probably the Boston busing crisis, where in the 1970s, whites in the Cradle of Liberty rose up against busing, which is busing African-American students into white schools and white students into African-American schools. And throughout Boston, there was waves of violence and beatings and a pervasive racial tension. Right there in the home, in the supposed home of liberty.
One of the chapters in the book is devoted to former Senator Ed Brooke of Massachusetts. He was recently awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. He was elected in 1966. He became the first black U.S. senator since Reconstruction. You know, blacks are a tiny minority of the population in Massachusetts. And how do you square that? I mean, how do you square the fact that Massachusetts is willing to send, you know, an African-American to the United States Senate, but you've also got neighborhoods where people are also willing to throw bricks at your head for wanting to go to the same school?
So I had the chance to ask Senator Brooke in an interview exactly the question you're asking. In his public comments, he was saying that Massachusetts voters were colorblind. But I think privately, Brooke had a very strong sense that people weren't truly colorblind and that they were seeing that he was black.
You talk about other significant figures in African American history who came to prominence in the North, like Jackie Robinson, you know, like Ed Brooke, like Shirley Chisholm, the first black woman to serve in Congress, who was elected from Brooklyn. And you point out that these strides were taking place at the same time that there's very real segregation in neighborhoods, sometimes, you know, real sort of street level conflicts. What do you think that says?
Well, I think that says that Americans, white and black, are able to make breakthroughs and make strides on certain levels of society, on levels where it seems that less power is at stake, where the threat isn't so obvious. For instance, to white people in Massachusetts, there was no necessary connection between voting for Ed Brooke and sending their child to an integrated school. And similarly, for whites in Brooklyn in 1947 and 48, they believed that they could root for Jackie Robinson, that they could welcome this first African-American across the racial threshold, and at the same time that they could start moving to the suburbs and that they could sign housing petitions, which was when word got around that an African-American might be buying in your neighborhood, the response wasn't like it might have been in the South to go out and sort of throw rocks. The response would be to do something more subtle and more silent. When Jackie and Rachel Robinson first tried to look for a home, they were met with stiffness by realtors and by builders and by owners, and it took them years to finally find a lot of land that they could build on. And we're not just talking about a regular African-American here. We're talking about Jackie Robinson. I think those stories speak volumes about the distance between sort of breakthroughs on the levels of politics and culture versus breakthroughs on the level of society and spatial segregation.
Did you ever come up with a theory, particularly given that your first book was about the South and about white Southerners in particular, what have you come up with as an explanation for why it is that white Northerners, despite their issues around having their kids go to integrated schools or living in integrated neighborhoods, were still willing to grant black people the franchise, allow them to vote, and in some cases vote for black people as elected leaders?
One of the differences is in the histories of the societies, which is that there is a big difference in a place where slavery has hung on so long and so centrally in the economy, and where the Jim Crow system and lynching and sharecropping persisted for so long in the South. I think also one big thing is that in the North, these were basically urban and suburban places that I'm looking at, from Boston to Brooklyn. You don't have rural areas that have the history that rural areas in the South do. I mean, in the South, if you go to a place, a county in Mississippi or in Greene County, Alabama, or a place like that, you have places that are 80% African American and 20% white. And you don't get many of those, at least countywide, in the North. You have places where there's more mixing and where whites don't see African Americans as much of a threat. In the South, after the Voting Rights Act, when African Americans got the vote, they could suddenly control counties and control courthouses when they were in such a vast majority. And that threat simply didn't exist in the North.
So what's the new news about Black history?
Yeah.
That we should all know.
The new news, I think, is that the 1960s is the period that I study most closely. And I think there are a few tried and true narratives that we have about the 1960s. We have, of course, the narrative of the Southern Civil Rights Movement, of people struggling up against Jim Crow. We also have the story of Black Power. People know this story of Stokely Carmichael and, you know, clenched fists in the streets of northern cities. But I think a person like Ed Brooke has been harder for those main narratives to make sense of, because Brooke was not a civil rights leader. He didn't call himself a civil rights leader. He called himself a politician. And he sparked a lot of controversy. He was a Republican. He was not a conservative. He was a Republican liberal. But he still got a lot of flack from the Black Power community and from the civil rights community. And I think for a long time, Black history had been about finding the heroes, the downtrodden, who had risen up and conquered. And I think Ed Brooke, although his achievements and accomplishments are just as remarkable, he didn't see himself as achieving that kind of a feat. And so he doesn't fit quite as well into these main stories we have of triumph and heroism.
Jason Sokol is an historian and resident fellow at Harvard University's W.E.B. Du Bois Institute, where he's writing The Northern Mystique, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. It's a book about politics and race in the Northeast. And he's kind enough to join us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for visiting with us.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.